Affairs will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Hope everybody had a good vacation. We're going to be doing a number of bills today and two work sessions that we know of at this point. So we're going to go right ahead to our first work session, House Bill 3010. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3010 and have the staff refresh our memory on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We last heard House Bill 3010 on March 21st. This bill requires the Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services to adopt rules conforming to the federal regulations relating to the erection of steel.
Thank you. Committee, we had a lot of testimony on this, and there's a lot in your bill pack that you might notice, and so we wanted you to have time to consider it, meet with people, and read it. And I believe we now are able to move ahead. I don't see our bill sponsor here in the room, so I assume he does not want to speak on this bill.
He's just running out.
I want to ask if he wants to speak.
Wait.
Jeff, do you want to come to the docket just see if the committee has any questions for you before we make the motion on this?
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Does the committee have any questions on the bill? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, thank you. I know we've talked a few times tonight. Just continue to have some questions with respect to certainly, I appreciate your all the steel workers you brought in the other day. And gosh, look at the testimony on this as I try to go through and figure out where my question is at. But if Oregon is to adopt federal standard, what protections do the contractors have that's going to help them maintain if they have a stronger safety record and more stringent guidelines, that they'll be able to continue to maintain some of those, almost, you know, continue to operate exactly how they're operating today, because that translates to cheaper, you know, savings in their workman's comp, their liability insurance, and all those things.
For the record, my name is Jeff Carlson. I represent Ironworkers Local 29. Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos. Prior to the federal rule, the trigger height in for fall protection for connectors in the state of Oregon was at 25 feet, and it didn't impact. And House Bill 3010 does not dictate what contractors can have as a safety requirements on their projects. In fact, doesn't even come close to that. As far as insurances and everything, my employers are the ones that are going to be paying the workers' comp insurance and so on, and they are in support of this bill.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Kitts?
Mr. Carlson, I want to make sure that I understand the bill crystal clear. While the federal standards are at 30 feet, state standards are at 10 feet, the contractor, Intel, for example, has the right in the negotiations to make it as low as 6 feet if they want. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, yes, that is true.
So there is a provision to lower from 30 feet to whatever the contractor so deems necessary or acceptable.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that we, the Committee on Business and Labor, move House Bill 3010 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts has moved House Bill 3010 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair, this was a difficult issue to me because it involves safety, and we had safety arguments coming from two different directions. Ultimately, however, I feel like the people who are in the industry understand best the safety issues. that exist, and I can't imagine a union advocating for a law that would endanger the lives of their own workers. It just, that would go against anything that I understand about workers representing themselves. And I also realized that in the testimony we had companies saying that they did not want this because they've been using a 6-foot fall protection for the last 10 years. But during the 10 years they've been using that 6-foot fall protection, state rules have been at 25 feet. So it's very clear that contractors can establish higher levels of protection that they see as appropriate for the job site, and that that will continue under this bill. So for those reasons, I'm supporting the bill that we have before us today.
Thank you very much. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I continue to have some questions. I do support the iron workers' desire and ability to and respect their knowledge of, you know, what's safe for them. And I'll support this bill today, but want to just reserve judgment. Should, you know, more of my questions be answered later, that it won't necessarily reflect how I'll vote on the floor, but certainly willing to support today and continue that discussion.
Okay. Thank you very much. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallagher?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Burkin?
Aye.
Representative
Chopwitz?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Both aye. Motion carries. And Representative, we have a burning desire to carry this bill. Representative Merkley, would you like to carry it?
Happy to.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3010, open a public hearing on House Bill 2683, and we have two of our esteemed colleagues in the room. Please come forward, Representative March and Senator Ferriol.
Which one?
This is 2683. And the staff will read a summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2683 creates the Oregon Quality Jobs Board and establishes duties and responsibilities. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we have a -1 amendment in your package that alters the membership of the Oregon's Quality Job Board by changing from 4 to 2 members representing the natural resource agencies, and it adds 2 members who are employed by the wood product companies. Thank you.
Good morning.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'll begin with my colleague's permission.
I defer to you.
Madam Chairman, this is one of those cases where you can do a great deal of good if you don't care who gets the credit. House Bill 2683 is eerily similar to Senate Bill 441, which is being worked over in the Senate. But the fact of the matter is, Madam Chairman, I think the amendments that you've made to Senate Bill 441, or actually House Bill 2683, suggesting the change in membership is progress, positive. So I would support the amendment. This is an attempt to get jobs in the woods. It's an attempt to capture some value that's currently not being captured in employment opportunities in Oregon's forests. It would involve a group of folks sitting down to talk about how to do some sustainable management, thinning, stand management, stocking control, improvements to ecosystem function, including weed eradication and juniper removal. It's an opportunity for folks from business and labor to get together, figure out what it is that we should be able to do to manage our forests sustainably, and then do some demonstration projects on state lands, on federal lands, starting on a smaller scale, but with good success, hopefully we can generalize that to larger scale projects. And the best part of this, it's community based. One of the things that we've had difficulty with for anybody who has followed the forest products issues is retaining jobs in the natural resource sector, particularly on a forest base. What this gives us an opportunity to do is bring together folks from the environmental community, from the wood products sector itself, from a couple of different state agencies, and from labor. And essentially, it's all those folks that are in the decision-making loop that would create opportunities for sustainable forest management. So we're hoping that we can send a clear and strong message that it's time for us to take better care of the natural resource heritage that Oregon has, time for us to get back in the woods, particularly after we've suffered a couple of very devastating fire seasons that are looking like we're going to enter into yet another. We need to get something done, and this is an opportunity for us to start on a smaller scale with some demo project to get something done.
Well, thank you, Senator, and I want to congratulate you publicly on your tireless work for the natural resources community.
I'm Jim, and right back at you. Thank you.
Same March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent District 46 in the center of Portland, and as you can tell from the two of us sitting here, this bill has broad support from people interested in economics and jobs in the woods, and from labor and from environmentalists. As the senator mentioned, it starts out with the demonstration projects. We anticipate the cost to be relatively low, in that these are projects that are going to be done anyhow. And by taking five of these as demonstration projects, we can put some people to work in some restoration projects and some thinning projects, and get a demonstration of how we can work together to restore the health of the forests and communities as well. So with that, I'll throw it open for questions.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you.
Okay, we'll call Bill Kluning, Ed Glad, Charles Spencer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Ed Glad. I'm with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. What you have before you today is one of those stories that starts 10 or 12 years ago when the Clinton folks came to town and came up with a forest plan that was never fully implemented. There was components, though, that were implemented, including a concept of what we call jobs in the woods. There was several million dollars that was dedicated year after year for forest restoration projects on the federal forests. In the meantime, the Oregon Department of Forestry is probably one of the premier forestry research and development operations in the world. Had already established a great program for forest restoration, and was moving ahead in a normal clip for their operations to do forest restoration. In fact, today or during this legislative session, you'll see that the Oregon Department of Forestry dedicates approximately $52 million a year to restoration projects on their own land. The Fish and Wildlife Department dedicates $32 million on restoration projects, whether it's forest restoration or stream restoration projects throughout Oregon. So this work is being done continuously, but it's being done in very segregated ways. That the Oregon Department of Forestry has its set of contractors, ODF has, or the Fish and Wildlife has their set of contractors, and they operate quite independently. Three sessions ago, we brought a very similar bill to the legislature, and unfortunately, we ran out of time as well as we did the last legislative session, very similar to what you have in front of you. What we're asking the legislature to do is to nudge these departments to actually work together to discuss what the forest practices and restoration practices are here in on our own state lands, and be able to model those contracts or the potential contracts, creative contracting, to the federal government to basically say, look, we not only have a workforce, but we have experience and we have contracts that work for this type of work, that are appropriate for this type of work. So As we came before you this legislative session, Chair Close was very gracious in showing us that the folks that really have a great deal of interest in this particular issue are the timber companies, and pointed out that it would be more relevant to make sure that the timber interests also had a larger stake in being able to direct the prospects of forest restoration. And so the amendments that you have before you essentially change the components of the board itself so that the timber industry has two employees, two folks that work within that industry to make comment and be a part of this this jobs bill. The other very interesting part of the amendments that are in front of you also we got some criticism from Jim Brown, who used to be the head of the ODF, and he pointed out that the bill wasn't clear enough, wasn't direct enough in its outcomes, and so he made some very good suggestions that we have also incorporated in the amendments before. You can see those on page 3 of the amendment sheet, which is to direct the agencies to streamline the licensing and bonding requirements for small ecosystem management contractors, as well as create guidelines for natural resource agencies and using to make contracts for natural resource and restoration activities more accessible to local ecosystem management contractors. And then the last there is to create a plan to actually direct the agencies or this board to create a plan that would improve the communications between state and federal agencies to coordinate natural resource management restoration activities and community protection activities that affect land ownership. So all in all, the work that we're attempting to do here is to bring together the agencies to coordinate more directly as to how restoration work is done and to get on with the business. Now, I noticed that in 3152, that a number of your names showed up on the bill, which is a forest thinning bill that Representative Canope sponsored. We have been talking with Representative Canope's office and are interested in working with that office to roll in the objectives of that forest thinning projects there. The difference between that bill and this bill is that we have a jobs board that is going to work more cooperatively with the different agencies as well as the different players within this industry to coordinate and to make it work. The direction of 3152 is to direct the ODF, which is one of the only named agency to actually proceed with this type of long-term contracting and local business concept. So all in all, I think that we're on track and that they're very much willing to go further with merging these two bills at the appropriations or at the next level here in the Revenue and Appropriations Ways and Means Committee. So with that, I'll turn it over to my partners here.
Welcome, Bill.
Chair Close, committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today. For the record, I'm Bill Clitting, representing the Western Council of Industrial Workers here in Oregon, representing over 4,000 members working in the forest, lumber, wood processing mills, and wood-related transportation jobs in Oregon. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2683. This will do two things. Oregon needs both these real bad. One is to put displaced workers back to work, especially in our rural areas that's taken the hit for 25 years, at family wage jobs with health insurance. This will start putting tax monies back into the depleted budgets that we have today in every layer of government in Oregon. And two, it will start the process to return our forests and watersheds back to a healthy condition. Overall, our forests, by the words of our own forestry experts, tell us the conditions in our forests are in bad need of repair. Fuel buildup and disease is just a couple of reasons why we're losing hundreds of thousands of acres every year to fire.
A poorly managed forest or a non-managed forest has three stages. First stage is green. Second stage is charcoal black. The third stage is ash gray. I would rather see the first stage in a well-managed green forest. At this stage we're at today, our program is like a jigsaw puzzle. All the pieces are unhooked. We're gradually getting the borders put together. We need a little help in turning these pieces around to get them all to fit together to put us a picture together of a healthy state of Oregon. Thank you, and I urge you to make 2683 a workable plan for the future of our state. Our state forests depend on it. I will try to answer any questions.
Why don't we go to Charles, and then we'll go to questions. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Close. I'm Charles Spencer. I represent the Restoration Jobs Working Group of the Alliance for Sustainable Jobs and the Environment. I'd like to talk about two elements of why this bill is being proposed, what the outcomes many of us are looking for, particularly the subsector of the industry of forest and restoration contractors and workers. We think that there's been a very difficult road for the past 15 years for small contractors and large contractors to figure out what's coming, what kind of work should I gear up, what kind of investment in equipment should I make, and can I retain the workers that I need in order to bid on some of this restoration work as well as some of the more traditional stand management work. We estimate that there's about 16,000 Oregonians currently working in the public and private sectors involved in restoration and ecosystem management. This sector is made up of trained workers and workers who have gained experience the hard way just by learning on the job, small and micro contractors, large contractors, nonprofits, and public agencies. And we think there's serious potential to create quality jobs for rural Oregonians. I've worked for the past 9 years trying to help rural communities work with agencies, primarily federal but often state, to try to accomplish some of those objectives. And I'm convinced it's fertile ground for rural economies. Dozens of small businesses have been started by rural residents in the past 15 years, and because this is a transition marketplace, many of them don't make it. Many of them do. Some of them gain from experience and contracting opportunities and training related to the jobs in the woods efforts of the federal government. But what we found is that a relatively small effort to coordinate and focus efforts in restoration strategies can have tremendous benefits in actually winning opportunities for small contractors in rural communities and their employees. The technically complex work of ecosystem management requires a workforce that's well-trained, well-compensated workers that know the land and have a vested interest in the long-term health of the landscape. They, in turn, need the skills, the knowledge, and the job stability and opportunity for future jobs with one contractor or another. And I guess I'll close by saying the good news is that we found that when agencies work together to figure out what is, in terms of existing marketplace, what is needed, and make well-focused, modest efforts, there's huge differences. Because when there is no focus, what happens is that the small business tries to listen for market signals and there are none. The agency tries to figure out who's out there, and what I see is they don't get accurate information. So it's a market that's not quite working. And what we do see is that when collaborative efforts to coordinate and set common goals are put in place, you see differences. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We don't have anybody testifying against this bill, which shows it's a very good bill.
Thank you.
OK. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2683. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2683. Committee, this does have a fiscal impact. It needs to go to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would move that we pass House Bill 2683 as amended.
I'm sorry. You do have the amendment.
Move a dash one.
Excuse me. Yeah, move the dash one.
I would move that we accept the dash one amendment to House Bill 2683.
Okay. Representative Kitts moves the dash one amendment into House Bill 2683. And as Ed was saying, this primarily dealt with the makeup of the board. And it's on your staff sheet. The amendment does. Okay. Discussion. Okay. Seeing none, so order. Is there objection? Seeing none, so order.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2683 as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2683 as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Both aye. Motion carried. Going to close the work session, or excuse me, the work session on 2683. And congratulations. Okay, we're waiting for Megan to get back.
Always waiting for Megan.
I think I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2906. And Megan, can you read the summary on 2906?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, 2906 requires that the methodology for established improvement fees promote objective of future system users contributing no more than an equitable share to the cost of existing facilities, and extends the time to file legal action challenging the methodology for calculating the system development charge from 60 days to a yet-to-be-specified time period. Amendments will be necessary.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you running in on short notice. And we will call for Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Executive Director, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 2906. Let me tell you a little bit about what the bill does, and then I'll talk about the process that we've made and some amendments that we'll be working on to this particular bill. H.V. 2906 deals with systems development charges. Systems development charges are a method that local governments use of fees, generating fees in order to support infrastructure improvements. And the goal of a systems development charge essentially being that somebody new who comes into town to develop, either a developer or an existing business that wants to develop in the community, pay their fair share for the cost of infrastructure improvements that will be necessitated by their development. And so a typical example would be some type of a traffic impact fee where an existing business in town would want to expand, and the local government would then say, okay, if you want to expand, we're going to charge you're going to add on to your building, you'll generate new automobile trips up and down the city streets, and in order to make the street improvements that we need to offset your new traffic, we're going to charge you a systems development charge, a traffic impact fee, for example. Now, the goal of a good SDC ordinance, and I think most of the local governments in the state, both cities and a number of counties, particularly the counties with urban areas, Clackamas and Washington and Multnomah, the goal of a good systems development charge is that the fee approximate the actual impact caused by the new development. And so somebody who would come in let's say, and generate 500, a business that would come in and generate 500 new trips a day would pay a systems development charge based on the 500 new trips that they create. If you have a systems development charge that that is insufficient, and so the new business isn't paying its fair share, then you're asking the existing residents essentially to pick up the tab for the new development. Conversely, if you have a systems development charge that overcharges, then you're asking the new business to, or maybe the existing small business, to pay for infrastructure improvements that the existing residents want but don't want to pay for. Instead of becoming a fee, it just becomes essentially an extortionate charge, because the systems development charges are tied in typically to the issuance of a building permit. You pay the fee, and in exchange you get your building permit. And so a good SDC ordinance will 99 times out of 100 charge a fee that's roughly proportional to the impact caused by the proposed new development. Now, the problem arises in that one out of 100 times where the fee doesn't do that. And so you have examples like the city of Portland. I think most of us have heard about the pizza parlor case in the city of Portland, where It's a Beautiful Pizza, I think, is the name of the establishment. An existing establishment in the city of Portland wanted to move their pizza parlor from one side of the street to the other. And the city of Portland said, that's fine, we'll allow you to move your pizza parlor across the street, but in exchange for that, you're going to pay us a $37,000 traffic impact fee. And of course, the restaurateur said, well, why should I pay a $37,000 traffic impact fee if all I'm doing is moving my restaurant across the street? And the answer was, we'll come to the city council. So they went to the city council, and the city council was nice enough to knock their $37,000 traffic impact fee down to $27,000. But in any event, at least you could argue, and I certainly would, that paying $27,000 for the privilege of moving your pizza parlor across the street is a tad bit unfair. We have another example in the city of Tigard, where Rogers Machinery, a client of mine, wanted to put a new building on the existing site in order to house their existing employees. So the same people who were going to be driving in and back and forth into the Rogers Machinery building the day before their building went up would be the same people driving in and out the day after their new building went up. The city of Tigard said, according to our calculations, you'll pay us a $37,000 for some reason seems to be the going rate. You'll pay us a $37,000 traffic impact fee, or we won't issue your occupancy permit. So, and of course, we said, well, why should we pay $37,000 when the same people driving in there today are going to be the same people driving in there tomorrow? And the city's response is, because that's what the ordinance says, and you won't get your building or your occupancy permit until you pay us the money. So we paid them the money and, of course, got the occupancy permit. But it's in those situations that, and whether it's 99 times out of 100 or whether it's 5 times out of 100, whatever the percentage is, there are those situations where that is, we believe that's unfair. And not only is it unfair, but it harms, it hurts economic development in this state. It makes it difficult, if not impossible, in many situations for small businesses who don't have the resources to fight, who can't afford to hire the lawyers to, by the time, in the Rogers Machinery case, for example, by the time that case worked its way through the court system, the legal fees would have exceeded $500,000 or $600,000 over a $37,000 traffic impact fee. So most people at that point, if you're a business person, would simply give up, pay the fee, and go about your business. What 2906 ultimately will do, or at least what we'd like to see this bill do, is two things. Number one, give a person in that situation, a small business, a landowner, a home builder, whatever it is, a person who believes that a systems development charge that's been imposed upon them is unfair, to give them an opportunity to challenge that SDC ordinance as applied to them. Now, you wouldn't be challenging the ordinance, the methodology established for the ordinance, but you'd be saying, as this ordinance is applied to me, the pizza parlor, as this, as you, City of Portland, as you apply your traffic impact fee ordinance to me and charge me $37,000 to move my parlor across the street, I want to have some process to challenge that and to get either the city council or possibly the circuit court to take a look at that and determine whether or not that's fair. That's the first thing it does, that we'd like it to do, is to create a process. Right now, we all thought we had a process, but the Oregon Court of Appeals in the Rogers Machinery case essentially eliminated our process, saying that the statute, the existing statutes don't allow for a challenge, essentially an enactment challenge. You have to challenge at the time the methodology is created, which is odd because in Rogers Machinery's case, the City of Tigers traffic impact fee was created in 1990. Rogers Machinery didn't come in with a building permit application until 1997. So essentially, Rogers would have had to shake their magic eight ball, look into their magic eight ball and say, well, 7 years from now, we're going to come in and submit a permit for a building, or for a building permit. We should go in 7 years back and challenge that, and obviously that's just not going to happen. The second thing that 2906, that we'd like 2906 to do, is to establish a standard so for these charges, essentially put in language into Chapter 223 that when the cities create these system development charges ordinances, that they do so in a way that essentially is equitable to everybody that's being charged. Exactly what I said earlier, the idea being that new business in the community neither pays more than its fair share nor less than its fair share. And admittedly, finding that line is going to be difficult, and local governments for the most part do the best job that they can, but there needs to be a process in place so that the pizza parlor, for example, could come in and say, look, maybe most of the time that you impose these fees, they're fair, but in this particular case, it's not fair. It's not a challenge to the methodology. You're not asking them, the city council or the courts, to overturn or overthrow the entire ordinance. You're just saying, in this particular case, as applied to these particular facts, this isn't fair. 2906, as drafted, does not accomplish what we're hoping that it accomplishes. As a matter of fact, I would tell the committee not to pass this bill out as currently drafted. It's not. There are mistakes in 2906. I'm working right now with the cities and the counties and the home builders to try and come up with some amendments to this that would actually accomplish the purposes, and I'm hopeful that we can make progress and actually do that. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Dave, maybe you addressed this while I was talking to my staff, but you have a blank in the bill, and from the, you know, the 60 days, what is your intent? What's the time that is needed to file the legal action?
Madam Chair, members, or Madam Chair, the blank there is actually what alleged counsel left with that, is that you would simply extend a time to challenge the methodology. Again, we don't want to challenge the methodology. What methodology? What we would like to see is that a person would have 60 days from the date that the ordinance is imposing the charge is adopted to file a challenge, essentially a challenge to the local government, and then possibly a writ of review to the circuit court, so that if the ordinance creating the SDC is created in, say, 1990, but you don't go in for your particular application and the actual charge isn't imposed upon you till 2003, you would have 60 days from 2000, from the day that the ordinance was imposed, or that the fee was imposed upon you in 2003, to file your challenge.
I see. Thank you. That makes it clear. Other questions? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave, could you just clarify for me, if one of these appeals were successful and the SDCs were reduced on a landowner that said they were paying more than their equitable share, is it assumed that other landowners would then be paying more in order to make up that reduction, or would that just be a loss in revenue that was supposed to be absorbed by the governmental entity?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I think the answer to that would be that whatever the formula, most of these SDC ordinances are adopted via formula. The formula wouldn't change. And so let's say the pizza parlor went from $37,000 down to zero. Essentially what you'd have is a finding that development wouldn't be creating any traffic impacts. And so basically there wouldn't be any improvements that needed to be made. I don't think the other landowners wouldn't be paying any more, but at the same time there would be a finding essentially that this business isn't creating any new development, and therefore there isn't any cost to the local government because they don't need to spend any money to do any traffic improvements. So I don't think it's an either or. I don't think the city would be paying any more, nor would the landowners be paying any more. There would just be a finding that based upon this particular development, this is the dollar amount that's needed to create the traffic improvements to offset the new trips caused by that new development.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I do.
Representative Stockland.
The system development charges as they exist are for street improvements, including sidewalks and sewer and parks. I don't know anything about the Tiger one, but I read a lot about the pizza one in the paper. I don't remember if they were asking for a zero system development charge, but I would imagine because they were going to move across the street, their hopes it was probably maybe a better building or maybe be able to expand, which may have impacted, might put a larger impact on the sewer and may have put a larger impact on the transportation, which I would hope it would mean they would have more business, which is every business's goal. But were there, in that specific case, were there street improvements and sewer, and I can't imagine how you'd even calculate the impact on the parks, but were they already existing in the new building across the new to them address, what they were moving to? Were those all in place, and was that specific company asking for zero system development charge or just a more fair, which I agree it was unfair from what I read, or do they want absolutely zero system development charge?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I can't answer those questions because my level of involvement in that particular fact pattern was probably essentially the same as yours. I read what I could from the newspapers, and then I had a conversation with the owner of that pizza parlor, but we didn't get into any specific details. Mm-hmm. Typically what happens and what we envision happening in a bill like 2906 with the new system in place, these cases turn out to be essentially battles with the experts. You hire a traffic engineer and they say the building will generate X number of new trips, and the city has a formula and they say based on our formula it will generate Y number of new trips, and then you ask the city council to determine based on the testimony of the people, the certified smart types, what exactly the number of trips will be. Alternatively, you could have a SDC, which I would think would work even better, where you would defer payment of the SDC for a period of time, and then once the business got started, you'd actually get out there and measure the trips generated, and based on the measure of the trips generated, then you calculate your SDC. I think that would work better. But as far as the specifics of that case, I can't tell you.
Can I make one more? Please.
Follow up.
First of all, I support the logic and intent of this completely. And I think what's lacking, I think, in formulas from several cities is their ability or maybe their willingness to take into consideration the fact that in a pizza place, for example, that infrastructure already existed across the street, and the $37,000, it probably was based on a formula as if it didn't exist at all, which that's the problem right there. Thank you.
First-time kids.
David, thanks for coming here today. I need clarification, if I might. Representative Rosenbaum had asked you about this being a loss of revenue. I didn't realize my question was that funny. being a loss of revenue, I want to make sure that I understand this would not be a loss of revenue in this situation with the way what your bill aims to do, because it would not be revenue that was supposed to be generated, nor would it be revenue that was factored in any way. Am I understanding that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, yes. The idea is that if the charge is based on the actual impacts that are resulting from your particular development, if that fee is lowered, then essentially you have either the local government or possibly a trial court, a circuit court judge saying, this is the exact amount of, or roughly proportional amount of revenue that's needed to offset the traffic impacts. If I'm going to cause 10 new trips on 72nd Avenue in Tigard, then the fee ought to approximate the 10 new trips I'm going to generate. Once the fee is in place, presumably if the local government uses the fee for what it's intended, they'll make the improvements that are needed to offset those 10 new trips. But so you're not losing any revenue. You're going to get the amount of money needed to make the transportation.
David, I think that your bill is a good bill. I support it. We spoke in my office about that. I think this is a great example of, from everything the governor's talking about, right on down to what the legislative body is talking about as far as streamlining regulation. And while we have a blanket policy, it doesn't always fit like it should. And I thank you for bringing this before us.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you.
And, committee, we're going to race onward now, and this bill, we'll expect it to come back in new form. Public hearing on House Bill 2906. I intend, for those who are waiting to testify, to do 3460 next, then go to 2632, end up with 2383, probably around 10 o'clock. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3460. Call Brian Krieg and Scott Berry. And the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3460 does a number of things. It establishes the Residential Structures Board, changes the composition of the Building Code Structure Board, transfers Building Code Structure Board functions related to one- and two-family dwelling programs to Residential Structures Board, transfers the administration and enforcement of code governing the mechanical, heating and ventilating devices and equipment from Building Code to the Structure Board of boiler rules, replaces one- and two-family dwelling code with low-rise residential dwelling code, and it declares emergency effective on passage. It has a subsequent referral to these means as well. Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning. Morning. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. Today I'm representing the National Electrical Contractors Association, along with a number of other clients. This bill is currently a work in progress. There are amendments that are being drafted currently for it. The bill in front of you will change in some substantive ways, and we are hoping to be able to bring the bill back to you for a further public hearing work session at a little later time. But briefly, in a nutshell, for about 6 years now, major groups in the construction industry have been working at trying to do something about revitalizing and reconfiguring the structures board. Currently, the board is a very large board. It has about 15 individuals on it. It's a little unwieldy. It's large in scope in its duties. And it's not really designed for the flexibility needed for the changing needs of the construction industry. So, as I say, many groups have been working at this. We've come up with a couple different proposals in the last 2 years, but we haven't been able to get enough people and organizations all arranged correctly on the chessboard. But I think we have it done now. We have most everybody in the industry involved in this process. Active groups include the Oregon Building Trades Council, the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association, the Plumbing and Heating and Cooling Contractors, the Oregon Association of Air Conditioning Contractors, UA290, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, NECA, Oregon Building Industry Association, the Oregon Building Officials Association,
the sheet metal contractors, and we've had a great amount of support and assistance from the Building Codes Division. I think the construction industry is continuing to evolve, and by restructuring the structural board, dividing it a couple of its duties up, we can better serve the industry and the consumers out in Oregon. Would hope that we'd be able to bring the bill back in a very near point in time so that you can see the hard work that we have put into this.
Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association. Good morning, and I would just like to concur with Brian's comments and say we're working on the bill. We've got a work group that is in progress, and this bill, if nothing else, has been very helpful for me in just determining which lobbyist goes with which contractor group. So I'm thankful for that after 8 years of working with these folks.
Morning, Larry Westling. For the record, I represent Oregon Mechanical Officials Association and, at this point, Oregon Building Officials Association. Just to pass on to you, we also are happy with the committee and its workings, and hopefully we'll bring back some amendments that will make the bill something that we can pass on through. I basically have been involved in the code development process and the boards for the last 20 years, meaning the Building Code Structures Board, and I think this would have a great improvement by what's in this particular bill. So and when we get those amendments worked out, be more than happy to come back and present them to you. Thank you.
Yep. Questions?
I just want to... Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't laughing at anything Mr. Krieg said, just for the record. I was laughing at this typo that says...
Easy now.
In our explanation, it says transfer building coddle structure. Forgive me, Madam Chair. I didn't want anyone out here thinking I was laughing at them because I'm not. I just found that very amusing.
It's what happens with vacations.
That's right.
In Florida.
That's right.
I just had a quick question. I noticed throughout the bill you've changed one and two family dwellings to low rise residential dwellings. Do you want to comment on where we're going on that?
Again, Scott Barrett, the Oregon Building Industry Association. The term low-rise just captures a different style of building, which includes two stories, four units or less, as opposed to a one- and two-family, which obviously just catches the duplex and the single-family home.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize we've got amendments coming, but I did want to ask you, in terms of the current budget crisis, if we're creating a new board, we obviously have to be wary of doing anything that makes operations of government much more expensive than it currently is. So do you anticipate that the cost of this would just be reallocated from the current building codes, or...
Again, Scott Barry with the Oregon Building Industry Association, Chair Close, Representative Rosenbaum. I think that, and then the group is working very diligently to try to address that issue, because I think we're all aware of the fiscal impact concerns that any bill might have. It carries a significant fiscal, but I think in the end we'll end up with no fiscal impact or a transfer of funds or a lowering of the number of people on the board, so that additional boards don't add impact. In addition to that, the bill will deal with the Tri-County Board up in Portland area and the cost associated with that, and by reducing those costs, we'll add more money into the pot for this particular process.
Thanks. Well, thank you, gentlemen. We will await the return of this bill then with improvements.
Thank you.
And I'd like you to know that Representative Kitts is putting in an offer on his first home today, so he's supporting your industry.
Congratulations, Representative Kitts.
I wish y'all could help me. They want to know what we make as legislators, and they kind of laughed at me. Keep running.
Larry Westling.
I thought it was Larry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Larry came with him. I'm sorry. Okay, we're closing the public hearing on House Bill 3460. And we're going to a public hearing, which I'm going to open on House Bill 2632. And Senator Ringo, not with us. We will stand at ease, I guess, while we're waiting for Senator Ringo to come. Other people sign up to testify, come forward. So
Brad Swank, is it? And John Powell. And Steve Morrell. We'll have the three of you come forward. And, okay. The staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee. House Bill 26.
Excuse me. Here's Senator Ringel. Please come forward. Go ahead.
32 allows an insured person who's injured by their own vehicle when it's taken or operated without consent to recover damages under uninsured motorist provisions of their own policy. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hope you got your running in this morning.
Sorry, I'm late. I didn't know you were hearing the bill this morning. For the record, I'm Senator Charlie Ringo, District 17. I introduced this bill at the request of an attorney that I know who brought to me a very odd situation relating to personal injury protection coverage. And as most of you know, we all have auto insurance that has PIP coverage that provides for $10,000 of medical coverage for our medical bills. Regardless of who's at fault for the accident, if you're driving down the road, you fall asleep, you go off the road, you got $10,000 of medical coverage, except in a very weird situation that came up that could probably come up once a year, and that is, in this case, somebody was a victim of a carjacking, and essentially the guy hit him with his own car, and he had no medical coverage. And he took that up to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and they said, no, under a technicality of the law, yes, it was your car, but because somebody else is driving it, you don't get medical coverage. That's what this bill is designed to address. I worked with John Powell of the insurance industry, and they don't have an objection to it. I understand that there may be some issues concerning the amendments, and frankly, I haven't had time to look at those or to talk to people at the judicial department about some of those details, and I apologize for that. I haven't seen the amendments till just now. So that's what the bill is for, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Okay, thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you very much.
All right, we will call Brad Swank forward, State Courts. And John and Steve, if you want to come forward and be on deck when you have time.
Chair Close, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm special counsel for the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm actually here today because of what we believe is probably an oversight of former law being carried forward with something that you may not intend to do. On page 3 of the bill, if you look at lines 35 and 36, it has an uninsured person or someone on behalf of an uninsured person reporting an accident within 72 hours to a police or judicial officer. I do note that this is new language because it's in bold, but it is repetitious of language that is in lines 18 and 19 and 1 and 2 on the same page, where we have people reporting to judges vehicle accidents. Now, I know that police and the Oregon Department of Transportation have procedures for reporting vehicle accidents to them, but the Judicial Department and judges don't currently and have not. We suspect that they've simply repeated the language, and this is a mistake that's being carried forward. You may want to take judges out of the vehicle reporting cycle. Thank you very much. That's the total of my testimony. I can answer any questions if you have them.
I think that's a very good point. I'm sure the judges don't want calls in the night about car accidents.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we will call John Powell and Steve Morrell, State Farm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. With me is Steve Merle, a claims attorney from Eugene. Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, Senator Ringo was not as prepared as he might have been, and I was out of state and just got you the amendments this morning to Megan finally, so I apologize for the mix-up. And House Bill 2632, as the Senator pointed out, does try to correct an area of the law in which a woman was injured when her car was taken from her. She was an employee at a Safeway store. After work, she went out, started her car. The warning light came on, the back door was ajar. She got out, and while she was closing it, a guy jumps in her car and takes off. Well, unfortunately, when he took off, the car door slammed, caught part of her clothing in it. She was toppled and drugged. Now, in this particular case, she actually did collect the PIP benefits under her policy. What this allows is a claim against her uninsured motorist provision of her policy in that circumstance. And the amendments before you to House Bill 2632 tighten up that provision from the way it was drafted in council. As it was drafted there on line 34, page 3, it just said the vehicle is taken or operated without the consent of the insured, which could be a broad range of events. What the amendments do is make sure that we're talking about an incident where somebody is stealing your car. Again, this is still a first-party benefit under your policy, and so it's not meant to cover every possible situation. So in a situation like the incident at the Safeway, then the person would be able to recover under another portion of their insurance policy should they have further claims. So what the amendments do is say that the person who was stolen from must cooperate in the prosecution of the person or the wrongdoer. And in the case that the wrongdoer is unavailable, and if the insurer does not pay, all they then need to establish by a preponderance of the facts that this did indeed occur, again, to try to get away from the potential of any potential fraud and that sort of thing. So we think the amendments would allow us at least not to oppose the passage of House Bill 2632.
Thank you, John. I know you're not the drafter of the bill, but has there been discussion of taking out lines 35 and 36 on page 3 or taking out peace or judicial officer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't think it hurts to take out judicial officer. Steve and I talked about that when Mr. Swank brought it to our attention, and it was, I think counsel just brought it down from the section up above. And the only situation we could think of would be in a very rural community where maybe there's a justice of the peace and there was not a law enforcement officer handy, and the person might go into the justice of the peace court and thus perhaps a judicial officer. I would think they could do that even if that was taken out. But I think what you would do in that line is take out the reference to judicial officer, not the entire line.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much. Okay, that completes our testimony on House Bill 2632, and as we can see, there's some amendments that are needed, so we will intend to bring that back. Close the hearing on House Bill 2632. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2383. And have the staff go out in the hall and see if we have any people here to test one. There's Pete Shepherd. We will call Peter Shepherd of the Attorney General's Office forward. And we will have Megan refresh our memory on the bill. And committee, we have had a work group that's met 3 times. And we've tried to bring you a bill that's much better than what we had in the first place. So, Pete is going to sort of walk us through what the work group did.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2383 requires a person who has a lien on a motor vehicle to remove the registration plate before a foreclosure sale. It requires a person who sells motor vehicles at foreclosure sale to apply for title to a vehicle for purchaser. Allows a person to sell 5 or less vehicles in a year without having a vehicle dealer certificate if the vehicles are sold by the person to foreclose possessory liens. We do have a -2 amendment. As well as a -3 with you today. And we got this just this morning, so I'm not that familiar with them.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I hope I didn't delay the committee in leaving the room. I am Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. In a former assignment in the department, I worked in our supervised our consumer protection section, and it's in that respect that I think that I make this appearance. The tow companies acquire a lien in a vehicle when they tow it. The practice evidently for a number of years has been that tow companies have not been regulated as dealers. That probably is an incorrect reading of law. And so what we have here is a situation in which the practice has been that tow companies are not regulated as dealers, have not been regulated as dealers, but probably should be under existing law. The fundamental policy choice for the committee is whether to change that situation, that is to say, whether tow companies should be required to be registered, regulated as dealers, or whether they should be in some way exempt from those requirements. In respect to that policy choice, the Department of Justice doesn't see a tremendous consumer protection content in either of those choices. We can manage, we believe, the consumer impacts of either of those policy choices. So as to that basic policy choice, I don't have a Department of Justice recommendation for you as to which of those two choices you would want, we would recommend that you make. I've tried to be helpful to the working group as it's worked through its materials, and perhaps what I could do in that vein then is describe to you what the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments would do to the printed bill as I understand it. And again, I've seen those as the committee has just today for the first time. In the printed bill, as staff has described, a tower who foreclosed on a possessory lien five or fewer times in a given year, in a given 12-month period, would be exempt from regulation as a dealer. But a tower who foreclosed on six or more vehicles during that period would be required to be registered as a dealer. That's the choice in the printed bill, and the Dash 2 amendments do not disturb that feature of the printed bill. It would leave that policy choice in effect. What the Dash 2 amendments do is add some additional requirements. Instead of requiring the tower to destroy the license plate, as in the printed bill, the Dash 2 amendments would require the tower to remove the registration tags from the license plate. So the plate would stay on the car and the tags would be destroyed, so that it would not be lawful for any person to operate that vehicle on the street because the tags wouldn't be current. That would require the person acquiring the car to get a trip permit, for example, if they needed to move the car on a public highway from one point to another in the course of selling it after the lien had been foreclosed. Or a person who purchased the car from the tower would have to get a trip permit so they could get the car down to get the registration taken care of. In addition to that, the Dash 2 amendments would require the foreclosing tower to file the same or similar kind of paperwork with DMV upon transfer of the vehicle from the tower to another person, or upon acquisition of the vehicle for the tower's own purposes. That would put the tower, in respect to that paperwork at least, on a similar footing with existing dealers. Those are the fundamental choices that are made in the Dash 2 amendments. In the Dash 3 amendments, there is an additional exemption added. That is to say, the printed bill exempts towers who offer or sell for sale fewer than six vehicles in a 12-month period. And the Dash 3 amendments add an additional exemption that says that regardless of the number of vehicles that the tower forecloses on, if the tower sells those vehicles to a registered dealer or to a wrecker, then those sales would be exempt and the tower would not need to be registered as a dealer for purposes of making those kinds of sales. So that is what the Dash 2 amendments do and the Dash 3 amendments do, as I understand them.
Questions? Representative Garrard.
Good morning, Pete. It's nice to see you again. Pete, this was, I think, originally all about license plates and tags. In your opinion, is there a real value to a plate that maybe has 10 months to go on its tag? Would somebody actually try to perform an act of fraud because of that 10-month period?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, there in the working group discussions that we've had, it did. I was persuaded that it's at least possible for a ill-intended person to make use of the plate. If there's a the risk of having, if you require the towers to remove the plates themselves, it's at least possible for mischief to occur with respect to the plates, and that there's less opportunity for that than if the plates remain on the car and the tags are destroyed by some mechanical means.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. We appreciate you taking your valuable time to help us with this bill. And we are waiting for, I'll tell you what's going on, committee. There's an impoundment bill up in transportation right now, and that's where Monty King and Al Elkins are. So were they intending to come back?
Okay.
They are not with us at this time. So, can you check the hall? We're going to stand at ease and just make sure they're not out in the hall.
It's assumed.
It's assumed. All right, okay.
We were here ready to do some work.